Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2002 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 on Tuesdays at noon. That's bcfmradio.com. This week, spies and warfare. Former Russian spy Sergei Skripal. Apparently, someone tried to kill him in Salisbury with a nerve agent called Novichok. Sounds very Russian. Maybe there's a clue there as to who did it. And that happened on Sunday, the 4th of March. There's been an enormous fallout from it, but not all of it seems to add up, as journalist Finian Cunningham, we speak to him from East Africa, although he's born in Ireland, and he has got some serious questions about the story. Then Bruce Gagnon, he runs a network against weapons and nuclear power in space from Maine in the United States. And he reacts to Donald Trump's announcement that he wants to create a new kind of army, a space force, a bit like the Air Force, only up in space. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio, one word, .co.uk, and we're based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft on Jamaica Street. I'll give you our contact details at the end of the show.
I'm Finian Cunningham. I'm a freelance journalist who writes regularly for Russian news-based organizations like RT and Sputnik. This latest incident is just one in a long series of, in my view, propaganda, information warfare stunts or campaigns to undermine Russia. I mean, we can go back to the alleged annexation of Crimea, the shooting down of a Malaysian airline over Ukraine in 2014, and the Olympic sporting doping scandal, the alleged Russian interference in Western elections. It goes on and on. There's just a whole litany of pretext to challenge and undermine the Russian state's international image over. And I think this latest incident of an alleged poisoning of a former Russian double agent it just fits into that pattern.
What, if any, are the real serious problems you have with what we're being told by the authorities? And it's mainly by effectively MI5, although they don't use that word. The Scotland Yard anti-terrorist branch is pretty much controlled by them.
Well, there are so many, it's hard to know where to begin. For a start, it's just the rush to judgment seems very odd, to say the least. I mean, in the space of a few days, even hours, the incident of Sergei Skripal and his adult daughter's apparent poisoning was right away attributed to the work of the Kremlin or Russian state agents without any hard evidence being produced. It seemed to be a scripted response that was preconceived, and there's been no hard evidence produced other than the word of British military intelligence and faceless securocrats who are advising the British Prime Minister Theresa May that it was a Soviet-era nerve agent being used. But we don't know that for sure. There hasn't been any independently verifiable information to assess that claim. I mean, the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov pointed out that according to the Convention of Chemical Weapons, the Russians should be allowed to have a participatory investigation in this claim of the Novichok, the Soviet-era chemical being used. But the British government have denied or refused the Russians access to this information, this alleged information. So that's another area where we're being fed a scripted kind of narrative.
Well, Finian, you could say that, but this is an ex-Russian spy who turned traitor while he was in Russia, and it does look like a Russian nerve agent may have been used in an attempt to kill him. So what other possible motive might there be other than Russia or Putin being behind this?
Well, again, I would say that the timing is just ludicrous. It just is implausible. I mean, this guy, Sergei Skripal was convicted way back in 2004. He served, 2006, he served 4 years in jail, in a Russian jail, for treason, for working for the MI6, the double agent. If the Russians had a vendetta and wanted to make an example of this guy, being really ruthlessly logical about it, they would have knocked the guy off back then when he was in prison, you know, through some sort of secret accident. Why exchange him to Britain in 2010 and then 8 years later carry out an alleged assassination just 2 weeks before the Russian presidential elections this month and 2 months before Russia hosts the World Cup? You know, the theory that Russia carried out a vendetta assassination on this man just is implausible. I think it just beggars belief that the Russians would carry out such a high-risk operation that would jeopardize, would completely demolish their already dwindling international image in the eyes of the West. Why would you give the West any more propaganda ammunition to denigrate you with? I just could contend that the timing, it just is implausible. It doesn't serve Russia one bit at all, but it serves the purpose, or serves the advantage of various other actors. And I would say the British government and their NATO allies have much more to gain in seeing the demise of this Russian individual, former Russian citizen. They would have much more to gain in concocting or contriving an apparent assassination with which to impugn Russia.
I mean, are there any specific circumstances about this chemical which was used that you think we should know about?
Well, we're having to take on trust that it is this Russian, the Soviet era nerve agent, Novichok. That's been reported in the press, and Theresa May has acclaimed those views. We're having to keep that on trust. There are several other organophosphate-related chemicals, VX, sarin, soman, tabun. They're all related. Apparently, Novichok is 10 times more lethal than VX, but it could be any number of nerve agents that were used. It doesn't necessarily just have to be Novichok. That's what the British authorities are claiming, but we don't know if that can be, it's not clear that that can be verified, and it could be any number of other, as I say, related organophosphate nerve agents that act in exactly the same way with the very similar symptoms.
Now, the Russians have asked for samples of this chemical. Is that reasonable for them to request them? I mean, you know, if they were behind this, it might not be the wisest thing to do to be cooperating with Russia.
Well, as far as I understand, under the terms of this Convention of Chemical Weapons Treaty, this 1997 treaty, in circumstances where, similar to this, if there was an alleged use of a chemical weapon, the other party has got the right under law to carry out its own chemical investigation to verify or to contest the claim. That's according to the treaty terms, as far as I understand it. And Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, cited that today, this anomaly, that they're being denied their legal right under the Chemical Weapons Convention to make their own assessment of these samples that the British claim point to this Russian, the Soviet era nerve agent. So, you know, it's... That's as far as I understand it.
Okay, and what do you make of the expulsion of 25 diplomats? Because this is starting to become quite serious.
Well, I think, hinted earlier on, I mean, there's a very reckless agenda that's been going on for several years now, where it's just a case of assertion and allegation continually being leveled by the British or the Americans and the other NATO powers. and there's never any evidence presented to back it up. So Russia is faced with these continual provocative allegations and then sanctions on top of the allegations, like with trade sanctions over this alleged annexation of Crimea, or in this case, are banned from the Olympics because of allegations of doping, or sanctions as of today, where the British government is ejecting 23 diplomats from its territory. Sanctions following allegations, following sanctions, following allegations. There's a never-ending conveyor belt of allegations and sanctions without any proof ever presented. So it's a very dangerous and very provocative tendency, rhetorical escalation. Russia is quite rightly saying that they will respond, they will reciprocate with countermeasures against the British. We are just getting into a never-ending spiral of downward relations that are leading to confrontation and even the danger of a war breaking out. I mean, this is how wars break out, because parties just continually are wrangling with countermeasures and measures and countermeasures, and the thing erupts into a full-on war. I think the British government are really playing with fire by escalating the response, expulsion of diplomats and freezing of assets, based on very tendentious claims about this incident in Salisbury. It's only been a matter of a week since that incident, and the British authorities appear to have a case closed against the Russians. Now, it just beggars belief that they could have done that in the space of a week, especially when we hear that there are ongoing investigations in that vicinity of Salisbury and neighbouring Dorset, where towns are being put under lockdown and being monitored for traces of alleged chemical weapons. The investigation is very much at an early stage, but the British authorities have leapfrogged onto prosecution.
What about the possibility of war between Russia and the West? Because that's where much of this seems to be leading. I mean, surely it's not in Britain's interest to have a war with Russia, particularly since that could be both powers, of course, are nuclear-armed powers. It doesn't really seem to be in Britain's national interest to be ramping up these tensions. Do you think it's possible that foreign powers are influencing the decisions being made at the moment in the cabinet and, for example, the National Security Council, these spheres?
I can only postulate that yes, there would be a war party, an overlap between military establishments in Washington and London and other NATO powers that certainly would be pushing for a confrontation with Russia. It defies reason or belief for an ordinary, civilized citizen to contemplate this. But I think there are people who have got a vested interest in war, armaments industry, and very outlandish notions of military victory, and they're pushing the rest of societies to a confrontation that will be the ruination of everyone. But I mean, the people who make war in this planet are not the most logical or moral councils.
That was Finian Cunningham. He's an Irish journalist who lives in East Africa, and he was talking about the attempted murder, apparently, of Sergei Skripal and his daughter, and also a police officer called Nick Bailey. Detective Sergeant.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
My new national strategy for space recognizes that space is a warfighting domain, just like the land, air, and sea. We may even have a space force. We'll develop another one. Space force. We have the Air Force. We'll have the Space Force. We have the Army, the Navy. You know, I was saying it the other day because we're doing a tremendous amount of work in space. I said, maybe we need a new force. We'll call it the Space Force. And I was not really serious. And then I said, what a great idea. Maybe we'll have to do that. That could happen.
Hi, I'm Bruce Gagnon, the coordinator of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space, based in Bath, Maine.
Bruce, we've just had an announcement from Donald Trump that apparently it's his idea. He just tripped off his tongue, this idea of having a space force like an air force. First of all, do you think it really was Donald Trump's idea? And secondly, is it going to happen?
No, it's not his idea. The aerospace industry has, for the past couple of years, been pushing very hard to try to get a space force, a separate military service, like the Air Force, established. And in fact, this past year in 2017, the House of Representatives passed a bill requiring that be done, but then the Senate did not pass it, so it died. The Air Force is officially opposed to it, as you can imagine. But under pressure, they've now created a new three-star general position who will become vice commander of the Air Force Space Command, which is headquartered in Colorado. And this new three-star position will be based in Washington, giving somehow the advocates of this new Space Force something to hang on to. But I think this momentum will now increase and the pressure will be back on the Senate in this coming year. I'm sure it's going to be introduced again. So Trump is really carrying out the wishes of the aerospace industry.
So what's wrong with creating a Space Force? If there's already these groups, there's Space Command, there's NASA, surely it makes sense to consolidate them into a kind of military force in space for the United States, can project its power around the world.
Well, I think there are several things. First of all, the Air Force says that it will lead to more inefficiency and bureaucracy, more officers at more levels, spending more money for more offices and locations, maybe whole new bases for all we know.
But didn't the Army and the Navy say exactly the same when the Air Force was created?
Oh, they did, I'm sure. But beyond that, I think the argument that I would make opposing it is that to give the space warriors any more of an official status and giving them any more money than they already have at this time is dangerous, because to have war in space is not something that we want to do. And we don't want to encourage these people in any kind of way, because their fantasies about having war in space don't match reality. And we don't want to encourage these people at all.
What about treaties, that sort of thing? Are there any treaties that say that you should not be having this kind of weaponization of space?
Well, there's been an effort by Russia and China ever since the Clinton administration, all through the Democrat years, all through the Republican years of various presidents. There's been an effort to create it's called PAROS, P-A-R-O-S, Prevention of an Arms Race in Outer Space. And every year a resolution is brought to the United Nations General Assembly, where it passes, although the United States and Israel always vote against it. This effort by Russia and China to close the door to the barn before the horse gets out, to ban all weapons in space, is being essentially blocked by the U.S. and Israel, who've long said there's no problem, therefore there's no need to ban weapons in space. There is an outer space treaty at the United Nations, which the U.S. signed along with Russia and other countries, but it only bans weapons of mass destruction in space. And now today, weapons that they call weapons of selective destruction are being developed that fall outside of that original outer space treaty. So there needs to be a new treaty to update to the new technologies. But the United States is, again, blocking that.
So what is a weapon of selective destruction then?
Well, it could be a laser-fired satellite that could hit other satellites, or it could hit other countries' ballistic missiles that are flying through space, or it could even hit targets on the ground. It could be a new technology called brilliant pebbles that would fire tungsten steel rods from space and hit targets on the Earth below. It could be an anti-satellite weapon that would be fired from Earth up to space to destroy another country's satellite, or it could be a satellite with an anti-satellite weapon on board that could destroy somebody else's satellite. So many different kinds of weapon systems would fall into that category.
Now, most countries that are superpowers would like to be able to dominate space simply because that would enable them to use that area and deny it to other powers. So surely what the US military is doing is actually what militaries are supposed to do, which is to try and dominate. And if they can dominate space, why shouldn't they?
Well, because the problem is space is quite unique. And today, space technology basically runs our technological society, whether it's your cell phone or your ATM machine, where you go with your credit card to get cash, or radio and TV, weather warning satellites. Everything now that we do on this planet is guided and directed by space technology. So when you start a war in space, what happens is you create all kinds of space debris orbiting at 15,000 miles an hour. And now suddenly those civilian satellites that have so much to do with our life on Earth today are in danger. And they're going to be smashed to bits, which creates a cascading effect that creates even more space junk. And soon everything in space is now essentially blown to bits. Which means then that if some country tries to launch a rocket to get into space, they would not be able to get through the minefield of all of this space debris now orbiting at 15,000 miles an hour. So this is a warning to us that space is in fact an environment that needs to be protected from these excesses of militarism. And that we cannot afford to have any war in space. Otherwise, we're going to be entombed to this planet and our technological society will come to a very quick grinding halt.
What about U.S. military plans beyond just space? I mean, we've seen all sorts of regime change, attempted regime change in Syria. Do you think it's possible that the U.S. military also plans regime change in Beijing and Moscow?
It's on their agenda. And we're seeing reports coming out of the Pentagon virtually daily that Russia is now an existential threat to the United States, and that U.S. must have regime change in Moscow, and they say the same thing about China. And the reason is because Russia has made it through the 90s when their economy collapsed, when the Harvard economic boys were sent to Moscow to give them the privatization pill, and it ruined their economy after the fall of the Soviet Union. But now Putin has helped stabilize that country. And now it's seen by the United States as a danger to the economic dominance of the U.S. And the same goes for China. So both China and Russian unity and collaboration, trying to create a new economic highway all the way from China, running through Russia and all the way to Europe, is seen as a major threat to U.S. and Western domination of the globe. And so for these reasons and many others, the United States and NATO feel that Putin and the powers in Beijing must be toppled and more compliant people put into office that would do the bidding of the West. This is, of course, a very dangerous and a very provocative idea, and very well might lead to World War III that would end all life on this planet.
What about Putin's recent speech, his State of the Union-style speech that he does every year in Russia? He's said that the Russians now have nuclear-powered cruise missiles that could hit anywhere on the planet. Do you think he's just boasting? I mean, these things can pretty much go high up into the atmosphere, apparently, as well as their ballistic missiles. I mean, the Russians sound like they now have quite a formidable force, which includes a space force and satellites and ballistic missiles. How does that compare to what the US has got? And I wonder, is it a bit like the 1960s situation where there was this missile gap and the American generals were obsessed with taking out Russia before they caught up with the technology? How does Russia and the US and China all stand in space if it was to become a battleground?
Well, you know, I said earlier that the U.S. has been blocking attempts by Russia and China for many years now to have a ban on weapons in space. In addition to that, George W. Bush pulled the U.S. out of the ABM Treaty, the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, that outlawed either side, the U.S. or Russia, from having so-called missile defense systems that are really key elements in U.S. first strike attack planning. The idea is that after you launch a first strike attack on another country, let's say U.S. launches a first strike on Russia or China, they then try to fire their retaliatory nuclear weapons. Missile defense job is to pick off that retaliatory strike, giving the U.S. a quote-unquote successful first strike. Well, after the U.S. withdrew from the ABM Treaty in 2002, both those countries said, we're not going to be able to afford to continue to be involved in nuclear disarmament talks anymore because our retaliatory capability will now be in danger by your missile defense system. So we can't afford to reduce our numbers. And so as the years have gone on, the United States is now expanding dramatically under the Obama administration, in fact, these missile defense systems. And so they're now encircling Russia and China, ground-based and sea-based missile defense systems. And so Russia and China are both saying that we don't want a war. We're not looking for a war, but we're not going to let you control and dominate the Earth and the space above. We're going to have to respond. You're not willing to sit down. You're not willing to negotiate. You're walking away from treaties. We're going to have to respond. And so both those countries are now responding by accelerating their offensive capability in order to overwhelm the U.S. so-called missile defense system. And this is, in fact, leading all of this together is leading to a new arms race in space that the world can't really afford.
Now, I know here in Britain, we've had just a week or so ago an apparent chemical weapon attack on a former Russian spy in Salisbury in Wiltshire, which has led to a response where we've seen 23 British expulsions of Russian diplomats from London and a tit-for-tat response from Russia. I mean, this does seem to fit with the idea that there is an attempt in the West to ramp up tension with Russia. Whatever happened in Salisbury, it's not been proven, and yet the response seems to be talking about closing down a Russian TV channel here, Russia Today, in Britain, which does a dedicated program for Britain during the evenings for about 5 or 6 hours. I just wonder if we can look, Bruce, at the various different ways in which it does look as if, not just in space, but in other ways, that there is an attempt to have a conflict with the Russians, which could end up as a nuclear conflict. What do you think is going on? Why? Because nobody in Britain or America or in Europe or actually in Russia, it seems, would actually want a war. What's going on here?
I think the U.S. and NATO have determined that they just have a couple-year window where Russia and China are not yet ready to fully defend themselves by a U.S.-NATO onslaught. And that's why we see the increasing demonization of Putin, the increasing demonization of Russia, the accusations against Russia and China for every imaginable thing that happens on this planet. This whole fake news story here in the United States that Russia interfered in our last election, there's no proof of it at all. Just like you said, there's no proof of this so-called chemical killing of this person, this Russian person living in England. So I see the U.S. and NATO consistently taking aggressive measures aimed at particularly Russia, but also at China, encircling them, expanding NATO. Even NATO is being moved into the Asia Pacific to encircle China as well with these new NATO partnerships with countries like Australia and Japan, South Korea, Singapore. So clearly, the writing is on the wall for Russia and China. The U.S. and NATO are coming after you. And so they're struggling to catch up as quickly as possible in order to just defend themselves, because right now the U.S. would be able to attack them very, very sharply with the forces that it is assembled along with NATO surrounding Russia today.
But you're painting a picture there of a country which is effectively, policy is being made by financial people, by the military. It doesn't sound like a democracy.
In the case of the United States, no, we are not a democracy. We are an oligarchy, and I believe if one uses Mussolini's definition of fascism, which he said was the wedding of corporations and government, then we certainly have that in America today. Democracy is a show horse, but it does not exist in the United States of America today. And I'm a full-time activist. I can talk to you for hours about all the reasons why I believe we don't have a democracy. Democracy has been drowned in this country, and I think throughout much of the West, frankly.
How has that happened? So how does that work? I think most of us would like to understand how as an oligarchy operate. You're saying it looks like a democracy. How do they do that? How do they give an oligarchy the appearance of being a democracy?
Well, you know, they continue with the elections. They make a big deal about the elections. And look at our choices. We're in this country, Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton. People didn't want Hillary. And so a lot of people, a lot of Democrats, actually, it wasn't Russia that gave us Donald Trump. It was Democrats in the Rust Belt states of Michigan, Ohio, Wisconsin, where the workers had been abandoned. Traditional Democrat voters had been abandoned by the Democratic Party. And so they voted for Trump out of anger, trying to shake things up. And surely they did shake things up. But it's not been a good shakeup, that's for sure. So they continue the illusion of elections, and they continue all the talk about democracy and freedom and liberty and everything else. But the reality is that when you look at what's coming out of the meat grinder of our Congress, it's all corporate policies that benefit the corporations, the rich, tax cuts for the rich, tax cuts for the corporations, dismantling of environmental progress, dismantling of the social safety net system. What little social welfare we have left is being destroyed in this country. They're going after Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, the three last pillars of the social safety net. So they're dismantling everything on behalf of the corporate interests across this country today.
Here in Britain, we're hearing calls for increasing military spending, saying that Russia is possibly the greatest existential threat to Britain. Although it's difficult for me to honestly say I think that Russia is threatening to invade and attack Britain. The military apparently don't think so, and some of the military think tanks don't. So there is a lot of pressure to increase military spending. Can you say something about what's going on in the US along those lines?
Well, in the United States, military spending is being increased. In fact, the Pentagon just got more money from Trump than they even asked for. So it's unbelievable how much money is being spent. Our entire economy today is a militarized economy. Our number one industrial export product of America is weapons. And when weapons are your number one industrial military export or export product, what is your global marketing strategy for that product line? I would submit that it's war, chaos, instability, demonization of other countries in order to create fear and to justify even spending even more money on the military. So this is what we're facing. In our own state right now, General Dynamics, which owns a shipyard here in my town of Bath, is demanding $60 million from our broke state, which is a lot of money to us here in Maine, $60 million. It's peanuts to this multinational weapons corporation. But they're demanding it because they can, and they're going to get very likely most of it. We've been able to cut the demand down to 45 in our state legislature. But because our state is so reliant on military production as a job creator, the politicians in the state feel like they have to give General Dynamics whatever they want. So this is happening all over the country. So not only are the federal tax dollars now paying for military, but now state tax dollars, and even the city of Bath has over the years had to put up about $85 million to give to General Dynamics. So local communities, cities, states, and nation now funding the military-industrial complex. It's not supposed to be that way. It's supposed to be that the federal government funds the weapons industry, not the entire 50 states as well.
Okay, Bruce, as a peace activist, obviously something that you must have thought about is how do we put a stop to this as citizens and as we are subjects here in Britain?
Well, it's a very difficult question, and I don't have any exact answer other than we have to fight them on every front possible. Sadly, many people are in a state of depression and resignation, and this really hurts our organizing efforts. But right now in this state, we're fighting against this $60 million request from General Dynamics from our state. And so we're bringing this issue into our local communities. Normally, the military spending issue is sort of seen as a national issue, but we're bringing it home, because it's come home to roost. And so the only answer I have is we have to fight them at every conceivable opportunity and every conceivable level.
You've and your organization against nuclear weapons and nuclear power in space. Can you tell us a bit about what the extent of weapons in space and the potential of having nuclear power and reactors, that sort of thing, in space is? Where are we at with this technology?
Well, frankly, they have many secret programs that, where they're testing space weapons technologies today that we're not able to find out about. One more indication that we don't live in a democracy when the taxpayers are funding these extremely expensive multi-billion dollar programs, and we're not even allowed to know what they are. But beyond that, every satellite today is essentially a weapon, because everything the Pentagon does on the Earth today, whether they're shooting a gun, shooting a missile from a plane, shooting a rocket, shooting something from a warship, everything they do in the Pentagon today is satellite directed. So the satellites themselves have become weapons. But beyond that, they are working on many, many, many different technologies to deliver weapon systems from Earth into space, from space through space, and from space to the Earth below. So they are testing each of these kind of approaches to space weapons technologies today.
If it did come to a war in space, as well as obviously a war down here too, and it might possibly even be where war breaks out, say a satellite exploding, one superpower believes it was another superpower that did it, and they start shooting or attempting to shoot down each other's satellites, who would win that war?
No one would. And this is the danger. This is the danger of this talk, that we can have a war in space and that there could be a winner. And it reminds me of the 80s and the 70s when the talk was by my country that someone our side could win a nuclear war. And we learned over the years through our organizing and everything else that this was insanity. And we brought the public to also believe this, that it was insane to think that anybody could win a nuclear war. Well, today it's the same story. Nobody can win a space war. And in fact, it can only create so much space debris that everything we do on this planet will be brought to an end, because everything we do practically on this planet today is hooked up to satellites. And when you start blowing things up in space and creating more space debris, everything becomes in danger. All satellites in space, whether they're military or civilian, it doesn't matter. They're all going to be smashed to bits by this cascading effect.
Okay, but what do you think that any one side or another side has a greater capability to, for example, knock out its enemy's satellites, to stop them functioning? Maybe it doesn't even send the satellite down to Earth, but it may have a way of just disabling that satellite and making it impossible for the military of their opposing country to use it. I mean, just looking at that, I mean, or is this just so secret, this area, Bruce, that, a lowly activist is simply not going to have access to that information?
Well, it's a little of both, I believe. I think that right now the United States does have a qualitative and quantitative advantage when it comes to space technology over both Russia and China. But they are closing that gap very rapidly. And what Putin basically said the other day was that we're working very hard to essentially overwhelm anything that the United States has. We are working to get around it, to overwhelm it, in order to be able to react to a U.S. invasion. Putin was very clear that he said, we're not looking for a war, we're not going to attack anybody, but if you come after us, we will make you pay severely. And it won't be worth the chance that you take to attack us. That's where we are today.
Is it possible to wage war just in space without having navies and ground forces involved?
No. Any war in space will also bleed, because a lot of the systems are going to be fired from Earth. And so, you know, and also there are ground link stations, for example, Menwith Hill or Fylingdales in the UK are both two U.S. warfighting ground stations. So if a war starts, a space war starts, one of the first things that Russia will do will be to destroy, probably with a nuclear weapon, both the Menwith Hill and Fylingdales ground stations, essentially taking out the U.S. ability to be able to communicate with its satellites. So the ground stations become targets, just as the satellites become targets as well. And so the U.S. has ground stations all over the planet in many different countries. So all of those places become prime targets for both Russian and Chinese nuclear weapons.
Now, Bruce, I'm not sure how much your knowledge is, but that's Fylingdales, I think, is in Yorkshire, as is Menwith Hill. But are there any other key sites in Britain which might be the target of Russian nukes, or, you know, in one way or another, the Russians will decide we're going to have to knock this U.S. base out.
I think Croughton is a primary one also, down in near Oxford, because it's being expanded now to be a major U.S. warfighting communications relay center. So it's going to be also communicating with satellites during wartime, feeding information from satellites to the U.S., using ground stations around the world that it taps into. So Croughton becomes a prime target as well. In fact, the Global Network will have our 26th annual conference in Oxford with a protest at Croughton on June 22nd through 24th of this year.
Is Britain just a part of a kind of wider U.S. empire? Is Britain, do you think, an independent country anymore? Because quite a lot of what we do seems to be just simply hanging on the coattails of the United States.
No, sadly, I think that Britain is a lapdog of the United States, the same way that many, many other countries, both in Europe and across Asia, are today. You're basically an aircraft carrier, an unsinkable aircraft carrier, they like to call it at the Pentagon, where you're a base for a location for U.S. military installations. Also, your budget, because space technology is so expensive, the Pentagon has long said that Star Wars will be the largest industrial project on the planet, in the history of the planet. And the U.S. can't pay for it by themselves. And so we've got to get the allies to help pay for it. And that's why we've seen, both with Obama and now Trump, the pressure on NATO to increase their contributions for military spending. And most of the systems that are purchased by NATO are American systems. And the word is that everything has to be interoperable with American systems. So anything that the Brits have, or the Germans have, or any other NATO country, it has to be interoperable. It has to fit together with the U.S. space technology system, which means in the end, it has to be purchased by U.S. through U.S. corporations. Now, it is true that Britain has an aerospace industry, and a growing one, but it's also hooked up to this whole U.S. system. And in the end, the U.S. benefits the most from these expenditures that are pouring in from the allies all over the world.
Bruce, this is an obscure subject for many people because it's not really covered very well by the corporate press in London, Washington, etc. Whereabouts can people find some information about your organisation? Just remind us what it's called. And also, are there any good websites that people can go to get the latest on space weapons and that sort of technology?
Yeah, our organisation, again, is called the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power and Space. And we have a website called spaceforpeace.org. spaceforpeace.org. It's either the number or the word for, either way, spaceforpeace.org. And we've got virtually everything there and links to many other places where you can go. We have a great space video section also on our website that I highly recommend you explore, and you'd learn a lot from that.
Now, Bruce, I know that with your own campaign in Maine to stop the public spending, the state spending on General Dynamics, you've been on hunger strike. What made you decide to do that, and how long have you been on hunger strike for?
Today is my 31st day. I've been, it's a liquid hunger strike. I'm drinking water with lemon, fruit juices, and broth. The reason why I started it was twofold. First of all, when I first heard about this demand by General Dynamics, fifth largest weapons corporation on the planet, for $60 million from our state, I was outraged, and I knew that as I moved into this campaign, I would have a heart attack. I was so angry, unless I began a hunger strike, because I knew that fasting always brings me some serenity. So firstly, it was a very personal decision. And secondly, I knew that if I went without food for an extended period of time, more people would join in solidarity. Right now, there are about 30 people that are fasting in solidarity with me for a day or more at a time. There are two people that are fasting with me daily. And I also knew that more people would work hard to try to stop this corporate giveaway of our money from our state to General Dynamics. And that's been the case.
Who are General Dynamics? What do they do? What do they make?
Well, they make the U.S. nuclear submarines in Connecticut. They're asking Connecticut right now, the state of Connecticut, for $150 million as well. They make destroyers in my hometown of Bath. And they make a lot of other weapon systems as well all over the country. They have an installation in Wales, for example, where they make sort of tank-type vehicles for the U.S. and NATO. So they're spread out all over the world. It's become an international conglomerate. And last year they made $3 billion in profits after all of their expenses were paid. They paid their chief executive officer $21 million, and they bought back $14.4 billion, with a B, billion dollars of their own stock. They had so much excess cash laying around, they bought back $14.4 billion of their own stock between 2009 and 2017, driving up the value of stock and driving up the executive compensation packages, which are largely based on stock value. So they're stealing from the people, making themselves massively rich, and then asking for even more. So, it's feudalism.
Well, yes, but so how come through the corporate media we have heard so little about this incredibly powerful lobby, which seems to be leading our so-called democracies to a potentially catastrophic conflict with Russia and possibly China too?
You said the word, corporate media. The media is controlled by the very same corporations that are doing all these horrible things to all of us. I'm sure it's the same way in Britain. And so this is what we see. During the Reagan years, they pumped so much money into the Star Wars program, they couldn't spend it fast enough. And so what they did with their excess profits, they began buying up radio, TV, newspapers across the country, the military-industrial complex did. And so now, this time around, when they're ramping it up even further, we don't hear about it because they own the media. They control the media. There are these interlocking boards of directorates. And so it's essentially the same people that own the oil corporations, the weapons corporations, the media, the pharmaceuticals, the drug, you know, it's all the same people now that run. That's why we say it's a corporate oligarchy that has taken over our country and much of the West.
That's all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. And subscribe if you like and listen the week before broadcast at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, that's Finian Cunningham speaking from East Africa, and also Bruce Gagnon from Maine. Bruce was from the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. Also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 on Tuesdays at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokescroft, just off Jamaica Street, on 0117 909 6897. They're online at prsc.org.uk. You can volunteer with us or for hundreds of opportunities elsewhere in Britain via the National Volunteering website, do-it.org. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.